So, today, we're actually going to do some physics instead of a bunch of math like we've been doing. So, this is where things start going back to the full circle. The way I like to look at this book, the first chapter is like a review, kind of like an advanced review. The next two chapters are really just a lot of math. And then chapter 4, we start getting into physics, but we don't really get into, like, the real physics. Like, you know, it's basically just reproving stuff that we already know and restating the new stuff. And then in chapters 5 through 9 is all applications and new stuff and actually understanding physics. So in a lot of ways, it's sort of like in Jackson's electrodynamics where, you know, you start off with the electrostatic stuff, which is meant to be sort of a review, and the magnetostatics, and then you go to boundary condition stuff, and you work your way up to actually getting into the electrodynamics and the electromagnetic waves, and then after that, it's all applications. And so this is, in many ways, the same thing. So what we're going to talk about is the physics in curved space-time, which basically means the place where general relativity lives and gravity lives. And so some of this stuff may sound like deja vu from beginning, first lecture. And so there are two parts to any theory of gravity. One is how gravity influences matter, and two is how matter affects gravity. And so this makes sense because you know that in order to have a gravitational field, you have to have some kind of matter there to kind of create the gravitational field. And then you have to have some other matter that's going to feel the gravitational field. So those are the two. The way Newton does it is how gravity influences matter. You've got an acceleration of gravity, which is proportional to the gradient of some potential, which is a gravitational potential. And as far as how matter affects gravity, the gravitational potential, the Laplacian of that, goes something like 4 pi times its constant times some mass or density. And so this looks a lot like the electrostatic equation where you look at potential and you look at charge density. So that's what we already knew from Newton. We moved to general relativity. We have curvature now, and curvature is going to change a lot of things. First off, we know that curvature acts on matter. If matter is moving through space and it impacts its curvature, then the curvature is going to cause it to follow a geodesic. And then matter is going to cause curvature, and that's kind of the second part that needs to be worked out. So this first part is basically the geodesic equation. The second part is really the Einstein equation. Yeah?
So you can have gravity without matter.
That's the idea. Or is that, at least classically, as far as we know, you can't have matter. Can't have gravity without matter.
But you could have matter without gravity.
No. Because if you have matter, then the idea is that, all right, let's say there was just one thing in the universe, and that thing was, like, massive. If it created a gravitational field, you couldn't tell if there's nothing else to feel it. So it's kind of hard to say exactly, but
a tree falls in the forest, you won't be there to hear it. It'll still make a sound.
But as far as this goes, you do need to have, as far as we know, you do need to have something to cause the gravitational field, and we think that relates to matter. And later on, we could say that, well, if that relates to curvature, then the matter causes the curvature, which causes the gravitation, and that's Einstein's theory. You know, and the thing is, this is still just a theory, because, after all, this could all be wrong, and gravity could end right now, and we'll end up floating off the Earth, and who knows. Possible, who knows? Not very likely, though. So, using the Einstein equivalence principle, it's possible to detect a gravitational field using local experiments because gravity is universal and its effect on all particles and energy is the same. And the reason how we can detect this gravitational field is just because of this, the Riemann curvature tensor, and the fact that, you know, when you drop two things in a gravitational field, they don't fall straight down, they fall towards the center of the gravitational field. You know, whenever you see, like, science fiction, and they have these artificial gravity on these ships, and you notice that things do fall straight down because the gravity is just caused by the floor as opposed to some central point. But in real gravity, it's pulling straight down, and so therefore you can tell a difference between that and just some acceleration. Now, because gravity affects everything, we can think of gravitation as a result of curvature. And it makes sense, and this is just kind of the philosophical part in saying that gravity affects everything. Everything, no matter what its charge is still affected by gravity. Curvature also affects everything because everything is going to follow these same geodesics through the curve space-time. And so therefore, you can just assume that they're the same thing. You know, if I give you something and it's got an orange texture to it and it's a fruit and you peel it open and it has little slices inside, you could pretty much assume it's an orange. And that's pretty much what's going on here. So we have this minimum coupling theory or principle, which says that if you start with physics in an inertial coordinates of flat space, and then you write them in a coordinate invariant form, and then assert that the law is true in general coordinates. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, basically, we start off with some laws of physics. Like, you could take electrodynamics, for example. Or you could take fluid physics, or something like that. And you can basically show that this physics works in flat space, how we're normally detecting it. Then you can rewrite that physics in a coordinate invariant form. And in the case of electrodynamics, we would use the electromagnetic force tensor as opposed to individual electric and magnetic fields. And then you can assert this law is true in general coordinates. I don't know. I did a talk last week on relativistic MHD, and that's basically the same thing we did here. So let me give you an example, something more concrete to work on from that. You have here eta, which is the flat space Minkowski metric, and you change your eta to g, which is the general space-time metric. And so what you've done is, if you can write your physical law, whatever it is, using the eta's, then you can just change it to g in now general space. And you take everywhere where there was a partial derivative or a divergence, and you turn that into a covariant derivative. And what you've just done is just taken your whatever physical situation and just converted it into one that is works for generalized curvature. And so, for example, in flat space, in inertial coordinates, you know that if you don't have an external force, you get no acceleration from an object. So the acceleration equals zero. And where this x here represents the path that some particle's taking, and it says it's going to move along a constant path. And lambda is the affine parameter, which could be like time. Well, this acceleration can be thought of like this, where we're basically saying that the second derivative is the same thing as if you take this first derivative here, with respect to lambda, and then you have this partial derivative of the velocity. So you can almost see here that if you take this partial, it's just like taking another derivative of this, but with respect to the coordinate. And if this was the law that you had, you can rewrite it to say that this is true. So all we did was just take the partial derivative and we replace it with a covariant derivative. And then this covariant derivative basically gives us something like this, where you can see you have first the first derivative, and then you have the partial derivative, and then you have this other term, which comes from the Christoffel connection. And so this little law that says that, you know, the acceleration is zero in the absence of a force turns into the geodesic equation. And so this says it's for an unaccelerating particle in general coordinates. Instead of it just not accelerating, it's going to follow the geodesics. Which means in flat space, they're exactly the same thing. But in curved space, you know, now it's going to follow this path. And that's also why, at least from the mathematical point of view, we can say that an object following a geodesic is the same thing as something that's being unaccelerated.
Yeah. So I'm not accelerating at a constant velocity on the Earth, through the universe, through the solar system, through the universe. I'm following some geodesic.
Yeah, but on a more basic level, you could say that there's a geodesic that you would follow towards the center of the Earth, and the ground's getting in your way. And so since the ground's getting in your way, it acts like a force over here. So therefore, you are experiencing a force.
The ground wasn't there, you would free fall towards the center of the Earth.
Right.
But then I would not be equal to zero. I'd have acceleration, wouldn't I?
No, because then you wouldn't be equal to zero, because your acceleration here would balance out this term involving your, with the Christoffel symbol and everything. And the result would be zero. So that's why it is that this is you in a gravitational field in free fall. And this is you in space just not accelerating in the absence of a gravitational field. And you notice in both cases, you got a zero on the right-hand side. And in this case, it's just you feel weightless because you're in space and you're not really accelerating and you're far enough away from the Earth, you don't feel it. And in this case, you're in an elevator, the cable snapped, you're in free fall, and you know, you don't really get that there's anything else going on outside of the elevator. And they're equivalent. And so the whole Einstein theory is built on the
idea. If you had a window in it, then you would see everything else accelerating past you.
Yeah, but I mean, the other option for that one, then, is you could say, well, you're in space, and you look out, and there's a spaceship coming towards you. And you can ask the question, are you staying still, and the spaceship's coming towards you, or are you coming towards a spaceship, and it's standing still, or both?
Both.
And, you know, if you're in that elevator and the cable snaps and you see everything rushing by, is it you're falling or is it that the Earth is just moving up around you or whatever's outside moving around? So it's all about reference points at that level. And you really, with the cable snap thing, I mean, the thing is you'll find out soon enough whether you're falling or not.
Earth accelerates towards you.
I think so. It's compensating for my minuscule weight being disconnected from it temporarily.
So the entire Earth is pulling towards you. Mm-hmm. That's one way to look at it.
And it really missed me because it's pulling up towards me really fast.
Yeah.
It's not going to miss you forever.
We want you back!
All right, so another example is the energy momentum tensor and energy conservation. So in flat space, or in Jackson, we might have divergence of this stress energy tensor equals zero for the conservation law. And all that does is it turns into covariant derivative of that equals zero. Either one, conservation law. But while this only applies to flat space, this applies to general coordinates. So you could basically just go through any physics law in that you have, and if you could rewrite it in tensor coordinates like this, where you know you're just all the dimensions are basically treated the same, then you can take one step and move it into something that works in generalized space-time. And, for example, this is what they do in with like quantum field theory or field theory, where they'll actually do, you know, go from a general field theory and then do it in a generalized space-time and have quantum field theory and curved space-time, which is actually the last chapter in this book, not one that I think we're going to get to, though. So, in the Newtonian limit, particles move much slower than the speed of light. Gravity is weak, and the gravitational field is static. And the reason why I bring all that stuff up is because if we actually work out all this stuff in general relativity, and we get things to work and say that, well, I can just make these little changes, and all of a sudden everything applies in general relativity, then I should be able to go from this and move it backwards to get it to work in more classical physics. And this is sort of like the same thing you do in quantum mechanics when you might take Planck's constant and you set it equal to zero, and all of a sudden you have something that looks like a classical system. So in this case, these are the three things you do in order to go from the Einstein limit to the Newtonian limit to show that everything still applies. And here, when you apply that particles move much slower than light, what that means is that proper time, for one thing, is very close to regular clock time. It also says that everything is moving more on a time-like vector than a space-like vector. So dxi d tau is basically how does it change in position with respect to proper time. It's going to be much less than how it changes with respect to t with respect to proper time. And so since that's much less, then what happens is you can ignore anything up here where you're talking about these being spatial, because the time components are going to dominate. And so that's why you get the dt, d tau terms here only. And so we just look at the gamma, mu, 0, 0 parts. We're still allowing this acceleration here to be in space or time. And so we're just ignoring the spatial parts of the four velocity. For a static field, and this is skipping to number 3, we would say that the time change in the metric is 0. Basically saying that the curvature of space-time is not changing with time, and therefore you have a constant metric, and so we just ignore all its time derivatives. Because in Newtonian gravity, gravitational fields don't change. I mean, you know, you got the Earth's gravitational field, it's always been there, hasn't changed much, so that works. So when you do that, what happens is, when you look at that Christoffel symbol, gamma, mu, 0, 0, the first and second terms are going to both drop out, because those are both time derivative terms, and you still have this last term. So this is what you get. Now, a second one is actually just describing weak gravity. And in weak gravity, you can basically look at, even though metrics and all this stuff is nonlinear, what happens in a weak gravity, we can linearize gravity. And this is sort of like what we do when we talk about gravitational waves. And we just treat gravity, or the curvature, as a perturbation on top of flat space. So we've got our flat space metric, and we've got this little perturbation, which is much smaller than the flat space metric. And so the inverse metric actually looks like the same thing minus the perturbation, where this is plus the perturbation. So that when you multiply the two together, and you should get unity, this is obviously unity, these two. This and this cancel out. Positive and negative signs are going to cancel each other out. And then this perturbation squared is going to be so tiny it doesn't matter. And so we can just say that the inverse metric is just... same thing, but minus the perturbation. And you can raise or lower this little perturbation the same way you raise or lower anything else. But here we're just raising and lowering it using the eta, not the full metric, because this perturbation is so small we don't care about the second order of things. And so therefore, we can say that the Christoffel symbol is just equal to minus 1/2 eta, and then the partial derivative of the perturbation. Partial derivative with respect to space, most likely, since it's static. And so, I mean, you know you're going to be able to just kind of forget about the time derivative terms. And so that means that the geodesic equation is now going to just be equal to this. And so when you take the mu equals zero terms, what you get is that the acceleration of the time component with respect to tau is zero because of the fact that the metric is static. So the perturbation doesn't change with time. For the mu equals I, the spatial terms, you get the what we normally think of as acceleration, and it basically goes down to 1/2 partial derivative of the perturbation and the dt d tau. But what happens is the dt d tau is essentially just equal to 1. The eta term, eta 0, 0, was just equal to 1, so that kind of canceled out with it. And so we just end up with 1/2 times that partial derivative. And so if you take your h 0, 0, your little perturbation, equal to minus 2 times phi, where phi is equal to minus gm over r, which is the potential, gravitational potential that you get from just having a point source or Newtonian gravity, then that means that G00 is equal to minus 1 plus 2 phi. And that's just from applying the definition of the perturbation. And so this geodesic equation becomes the acceleration equal to minus the gradient of the potential, which is, you know, since which is basically the exact same thing as Newton's gravity law. So, in other words, you can recover Newtonian gravity, or at least the part of Newtonian gravity that explains how a particle accelerates in a gravitational field. And all we did was just take the geodesic equation in the Newtonian limit and show that they come out to be the same thing.
And the Newtonian limit was that the position part change with proper time is much, much less than the time change. Got us back to the Newtonian?
Actually, there was three assumptions. There was the particles move much slower than the speed of light.
Oh, that one.
There was the gravity has to be weak, and the gravitational field has to be static. The gravitational field is weak is the perturbation part. The gravitational field is static is the time derivative equals zero, and much slower than the speed of light is this velocity of the spatial velocity is much less than the time velocity. So without all three assumptions, you just don't get it. But when general relativity really becomes interesting and fun when you can actually put, you know, when you can actually get rid of those assumptions and you can actually deal with the full space-time with all the curvature. And the thing about it is that, like, we, you know, we live inside of Newtonian gravity on Earth and we're used to dealing with it. And so when you think about it, this is actually weak gravity. It seems kind of weird. That's true. But it's like within, compared to the Einstein limit, everything is moving really slow in a very weak gravitational field, and it's not changing in time. And all three of those things can change. Yeah?
Well, I think since if I fell down an elevator shaft or the elevator thing, when I got to the bottom or the Earth came up to meet me, I would just go slat.
Mm-hmm.
Weak, in a very weak field. A little minute amount of me in those strong electric field, whatever parts of physics, result in a nuclear explosion. So I'm merely a splat.
Yeah.
compared to the strong field force.
Right. Like a strong force, when we'll talk about this, like especially when we get to black holes. But I mean, that's a good example of how strong a strong force can be with these things. And then when you talk about gravitational waves, that's when you can really get to see some of the dynamics, or cosmology, you get to see some of the dynamics of it. But a good example of a strong field is you're in a black hole, and you're orbiting this black hole. And you are basically standing up like this, the black hole's at your feet, and it's still pretty far from you. That's when you learn what real tidal forces are. Because the difference in the gravity and the curvature between your feet and your head are easily enough to rip your entire body in half. Where your feet will accelerate down a lot harder than your head, and the result is going to be rip. And so if you think about it, like on Earth, you know, you walk around on Earth and your head and your feet, they feel the same gravity. You go up 5 feet, no big difference. You know, and pretty much everyone on Earth, even when you're on a plane, gravity is basically pulling down on you the same way as if you're at sea level. And so that shows you how weak it is compared to a situation where it might be, you know, a few feet different. Forget it. So it's so it can get a lot stronger than that. And then, you know, you talk about, we're already talked a lot about relativistic velocities and moving near the speed of light, in which case that first assumption kind of goes away. And then imagining this gravitational field, it's not only really strong, but it can also change in time. Like if it's because the object generating it is moving around. Okay, so this is going to bring us to Einstein's equation. And before we're done here today, we will have derived Einstein's general theory of relativity. So the idea in Einstein's equation is you're going to use the Poisson equation for the Newtonian potential as a model. And this is the Poisson equation, Newtonian gravity theory, you know, made him the greatest scientist ever back 400-something years ago.
Newton.
Yeah. And so you've got this Laplacian of this potential is equal to 4 pi g times rho. And, you know, later on that kind of became a model for how do you make, for one of Maxwell's equations with the electric potential, when you write it in terms of potentials. And so the first guess, if you're going to try to modify Newton, is you're going to make something that looks like it. So we're going to look at the second derivative of the metric, since the metric, you know, it represents curvature some way. And so you take the second derivative of the metric, and you say that that's proportional to stress-energy tensor, which represents this whole mass-energy density stuff. Okay. So this would be the first logical step towards making Einstein's theory of relativity. The problem with it is that the left-hand side doesn't represent a tensor where the right-hand side is a tensor. Because when you take this Laplacian of the metric, you're really taking a covariant derivative of a covariant derivative of the metric, and the covariant derivative of the metric is always equal to zero.
So one of those isn't contravariant?
Well, you know what I mean. Covariant derivatives as opposed to partial derivatives.
Okay.
Right, yeah, it's a contravariant covariant derivative. Yeah. Like a really tall leprechaun. So here, this doesn't work. But what you can do, however, is you've got this Riemann tensor. And the Riemann tensor, it's not zero, you know, so you don't run into that problem. And it's constructed from second derivatives of the metric. So you do get this kind of second derivative in there, even though it's not as direct. So, you know, you get the second derivatives like with potential here. And so your next guess would be that you contract your Riemann into a Ricci tensor, is a tensor. And you say that that's like some constant times the stress-energy tensor. Problem with this is that when you take the divergence of the stress-energy tensor, it's always equal to zero because of conservation of energy. But when you take the second, the divergence of the Ricci, it's not necessarily zero. So that doesn't work. But from last time, we knew that you could use the Bianchi identity and get this, and if you take the divergence of this thing, you can get that the divergence of this combination of the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar is equal to zero. And so we call this the Einstein tensor, and we say that that is equal to something times the stress energy tensor. And both sides have a divergence equal to zero, but it looks like it works. And so therefore, we say that Einstein's equation is just this. Einstein tensor equals stress energy tensor. And it equates curvature to stress energy tensor. You can even play around with it a little bit, and you can contract it with the inverse metric, in which case now have a Ricci scalar minus a delta function here. Ricci scalar equals a stress energy tensor, which is equal to a scalar here. And in four dimensions, this Ricci scalar is equal to minus some directly proportional to this contracted stress energy tensor. And so you can say that the Ricci scalar, Ricci tensor is equal to proportional to the stress energy tensor, and then this other constant term over here, bracket from the stress energy tensor. And so you can effectively put make the right or left hand side more complicated. Okay. And so that also works. And by the way, you'll notice here that this condition where we set the gradient or the divergence of these two equal to zero works, but the divergence of the metric is also equal to zero. So if you take this metric, divergence, and you multiply it by some scalar, that's zero by definition. And so you can literally add on a piece to this equation, and it still works. And this little lambda here is called a cosmological constant, you know, which, you know, heard, you heard the story, Einstein called it his biggest blunder. Because, you know, the whole idea was he came out with this equation without the lambda term, and it showed that the universe was basically it was evolving when you put in the cosmology pieces and solved this for all the cosmology. And then he said, well, that can't be right, so we threw in this lambda term so you could fine-tune a piece of it to fine-tune the curvature to keep it from expanding. And so he threw that in there, got a static universe, and then they looked at the observations and discovered the universe was expanding, in which case it looked like this thing wasn't really needed. So we said, well, that was a mistake. We tried to erase it, and it wouldn't quite erase, so it was kind of stuck with it. And then about 80 years later, we found out that the acceleration of the universe was the universe expansion was accelerating, in which case you kind of need this thing in there to explain that. And so, like I said, the moral of the story is to never admit you're wrong and that you made a mistake. If Einstein hadn't admitted that mistake, he could have said, just wait around, you'll see, and then just go about his life and die. Nobody would have known any better. Nobody would have known any better. So, if you take the stress energy tensor equal to this, where this is just the stress energy tensor for some fluid, and for dust, since dust is the simplest fluid we can think of, it's just getting rid of the pressure terms. And so we just have rho and the four velocity. And then you take this dust to be at rest, so it only has velocity in the time-like direction. And so you contract that with the metric, you get minus one. And we say that it's going to be a weak gravity situation, so we just have these perturbations. Then what happens is G00 is the only terms that are going to exist in the metric from here. And so that means that G00 contracted with U0, U0 is minus 1, which is the same thing as saying that this is equal to minus 1, which you can divide through by the first part of the parentheses and take the square root, and you can get that U0 goes like square root of minus 1 over minus 1 plus H00. And you can approximate this to be roughly 1 plus 1 half H00, which is about equal to 1, which is what you'd expect. And H0 covariant is equal to minus 1. So when you multiply the two together, you should get minus 1. And therefore, you could say that the T00 component is roughly just equal to rho. Since you got T00 equals rho times the four velocity. So T comes from contracting the metric with the T00 term, which is just equal to minus the T00, which is just equal to minus rho. And so you can say then that your Einstein equation reduces down to R00 is equal to some constant times rho minus, I think it's 1/2 rho, which is equal to 1/2 times that constant times rho. And so that's the R00, which represents also the same thing as the Riemann, where you've contracted over two indices. And the Riemann comes from the Christoffel symbol, where you have this partial derivative of the Christoffel. We're only dealing with the 0,0 terms here. All the other non-0,0 terms, this one will go to 0, this one will go to 0. This one is actually basically goes like the perturbation. But if this is non-0, so does that. So it's perturbation squared, which is going to be really tiny. And then you've got, so you only end up with just this one term. And so we have our Riemann, which is just basically just a spatial derivative of the Christoffel symbol. And so the Ricci, again, is a contraction of that, which is this derivative of the Christoffel symbol. And so you know, again, these two terms are zero because we're talking about a static space-time. And then when you take this derivative and you apply it inside, you've got a derivative here. And this derivative is going to turn out to be zero.
Find the product rule.
Yeah. And then you have this derivative, which is just coming from you. Yeah, so that derivative would be zero. And you're left with just the Laplacian of G00, which is just the same thing as Laplacian of this perturbation. I'm trying to remember exactly why I set that equal to zero. Oh, I know. It's basically because this ends up being the same thing as taking the derivative of the inverse perturbation times the perturbation, or times the derivative of the perturbation. And I guess it just would be too small because we're multiplying together. So that kind of simplifies down to zero. So the end result is that your Riemann, or Ricci, is just going to be equal to this. And so when you put all that together, your full Einstein equation ends up being equal to just this statement, that the Laplacian of the perturbation is like goes like the density. And since the H00 part of the perturbation is equal to 2 phi, and we say that kappa is equal to 8 pi g, then we recover Newton's gravity theory. And so if we start with Newton's gravity, we can kind of work backwards and see what kappa should be and everything. So this is the full Einstein equation, written in terms of the Ricci scalar and tensor. And then this next one is the same rewriting of it, that this only works in four dimensions, where they just basically just moved into a scalar of the stress energy tensor. So this is one way to derive Einstein's equation. All right, so are there any questions on that?
How can I tell from your writing when it's Ricci and when it's Riemann?
Oh, Riemann has four indices. Ricci only has two.
Okay.
So all I have to do is just count the indices. Okay, any other questions? All right. I've got another way of deriving Einstein's equation, but it's not nearly as simple. And so we're going to go through that as well. And then you can, hopefully, you know, this helps you get an idea. You know, because some of these things you have to see from more than one point of view to really know that it's true. And a lot of this is, I mean, even though you can see it reduces well to Newtonian gravity in the right limit, it's still sort of, okay, you got these two things and they look alike, so we'll just put them together. And, you know, it makes it like, well, are we missing anything? All right, so this is the Lagrangian formulation, which is basically the classical field theory way of deriving Einstein's equation. And this kind of goes back to the answer to the question, why did we cover classical field theory in Chapter 1? So what you do here is you write the action in terms of the Lagrangian density here. And inside of here are the potentials or the fields. And so this is the generalized action in n-dimensions. And you can see here that we have this Lagrangian density, which is, it involves this determinant of the metric term and this scalar quantity in order to, and you have a covariant derivative here, so that this is for generalized spacetime. And so, of course, what we want is principle of least action. So we're going to minimize the action, and in minimizing the action, we get something like Lagrange's equation here. We have the derivative of the Lagrangian density respect to the field minus the covariant derivative of the derivative of Lagrangian density with respect to the covariant derivative of the field. Okay, so we have to actually go through this in a little bit more detail and see what does each little piece of this mean. Now, from Stokes' theorem, we know that if you take if you have the divergence of some vector and you integrate it over a hypersurface, sigma, then you're putting in this term involving the metric. And that's the same thing as if you just take the normal of that vector and integrate it over a smaller hypersurface involving one less dimension. And that's given by this partial sigma term. And so if you do integration by parts, you can start off with some vector, some gradient of some number, and this metric integral over a value. And you, by integrating by parts, you can turn this from a gradient to just a scalar by itself in a divergence here. And you have this plus some boundary conditions. So these are going to be some of the tools that we're going to use in order to apply this whole principle of least action to general relativity in order to kind of re-derive this stuff. I mean, this is some pretty powerful stuff. It's amazing that, you know, this is basically what Newton came up with in being able to just describe classical motion, but it also can give you, as we've seen before, it can give you Maxwell's equations, because they follow this principle of least action. And it's also going to give us Einstein's equations. So we're going to have S of phi to be equal to this, the integral of this stuff. And so this is the action of some scalar field phi, where what's happening is inside these brackets is the Lagrangian density for this scalar field. And so you have these two terms, which are like velocity terms, field. And we have the metric there and these covariant derivatives. Covariant derivatives would be generalized space-time. The metric is so you raise one and you can multiply these two velocities together. And then you have the potential over here. And, of course, it's curved space, so we have this determinant of the metric in here. And if you go through and you use this scalar field, then the result is going to be this Euler equation, going to be taking box of phi minus dB phi equals zero, where that box is just like saying you're taking Laplacians not only in space but in time. And so we can show that this works for just a regular old scalar field. For general relativity, the metric is going to be the dynamic variable. The Ricci is going to be the Lagrangian, and the Ricci scalar is the only independent scalar that can be constructed from the metric using no higher than second order derivatives. So let me explain that a little bit more. So in general relativity, we know that our dynamic variable is going to be the space-time. Space-time is going to curve. That's going to be represented by the metric. And the Ricci scalar is going to be like the Lagrangian of the metric, or the Lagrangian describing how this thing changes. And because it's the only independent scalar that can be constructed from the metric with no more than second derivatives. And it kind of corresponds to how this Lagrangian here, as you can see, this is a scalar, and it's constructed from the field with nothing higher than second derivatives. So, we've got, first off, the Hilbert action, which is to say, we've got the action caused by using the Ricci scalar as our Lagrangian, and so we're just integrating this thing. And so the Ricci scalar breaks up into the Ricci tensor and the inverse metric. And so you're going to find the least action. So to find the least action, you basically got three different least actions going on. Where the first one is where you do variations by the Ricci tensor. Second one does variations by the metric, and the third does variations by the determinant, the square root of the determinant of the metric. So this is three times as much fun as anything else you've done. And so if you can basically solve for each one of these in the least action, then you've got your full thing. Now to find the delta on the Ricci scalar, or Ricci tensor, then you basically have to start with the Riemann and then look at all the variations on that. And so the Riemann looks like you've got these Christoffel symbol terms, and then you've got lambda and mu, which can be interchanged. And the Riemann, Christoffel symbol in turn can be made out of the Christoffel symbol and perturbations of the Christoffel symbol. So the delta on the Riemann is just going to be equal to having covariant derivatives of the delta on the Christoffel, where you're just switching lambda and mu, because all the other terms within the Riemann, like these, are just going to fall out. And so that is going to reduce
to having the partial derivatives. So these are covariant derivatives. You got the partial derivative here, and then you have this term that comes in from another connection, and then a delta on the Christoffel symbol. And then you've got this other delta, which comes from, oh yeah, and then you have these other Christoffel symbols which come from each one of the terms within the Christoffel symbol. So since it has three terms in it, it means you have three more Christoffel symbols that pop up. One, which sums here for the contravariant part, and then these other two for the covariant parts. So what that means is that you end up getting a least action when you follow it back up, which looks like this integral over all of space and this determinant of the metric. And then you have this stuff, which comes from basically this Riemann term here with the delta and the Riemann, but you're expanding it out, or you're just contracting over rho and lambda. So here, when you take these terms and you expand them out with what's up here, then you can see you end up getting all these extra delta terms in it. And what happens is when you switch the order of, what was it, mu and nu on these, or lambda, yeah, when you switch the order on those two, what ends up only surviving are just these guys. Your delta and your Christoffel from up here. And so this is from taking the covariant derivative of this whole thing. Okay. Oh, no, sorry. What they did was they just moved the covariant derivatives outside of the brackets, and they moved this metric term inside, and then they just did a change of variable so that look like the same covariant derivative since it's being summed over anyway. So once they did this, then they were able to apply that Stokes theorem from actually a couple pages back. Since there's a divergence here, and when you apply that Stokes theorem, you can simplify this whole thing. So before they did the Stokes theorem, they just simply said, well, you, this delta on the Christoffel symbol is just all of this junk. And so when you apply, when you plug this into these deltas here, then you get something like this. And then you can apply the Stokes theorem, in which case you can get rid of that covariant derivative outside of the brackets. And then when you look at what's left, you basically end up with just covariant derivatives of the metric. And so at the boundary, this is going to vanish. So delta S1 ends up just disappearing. Delta S3 is going to use the fact that the natural log of a determinant of a matrix is equal to the trace of the natural log of the matrix, of the whatever's inside of it. Where M can be thought of as the exponential of the natural log of whatever M for any matrix. So this is basically going to be used, because what we need to do is we need to see how the variation is with respect to the square root of the determinant. And so 1 over the determinant of M times delta of the determinant of M should be the same thing as having the trace of M inverse times delta of M. So 1 over G delta G is the same thing as taking the metric, inverse metric, and contracting it with the delta of the metric. And by this contraction, it's basically the same thing as taking the trace. And so what this means is that delta G is equal to taking minus the determinant of the metric, and then that multiplied by this G mu nu, delta G mu nu.
since this delta G of mu nu is just equal to this combination of the metric and the inverse determinant of the metric, and this just comes from just simple tensor calculus, then delta of the square root of the metric, the square root of the determinant of the metric, is just equal to minus 1 over 2 times the square root of the determinant of the metric times the delta on the determinant of the metric, which you can expand out as being equal to this, is in the terms on the last page. And so this is just metric divided, determinant of the metric divided by square root of determinant of the metric, which is just going to be square root of determinant of the metric. And so, and they added in this minus 1 because the metric would have a minus signature from the determinant. And so delta S3 is just equal to this stuff. And so,
let's see. So what we did then is we just added in delta S2, we already had the delta of the metric, so we didn't have to do anything special with that to get it in the right form. And so we just took delta S2, which already had this Riemann, and delta S3, which has all this stuff, and the Ricci scalar. Delta S1, of course, ended up going to 0. And so you end up getting all this.
Now, since the delta S is going to be like the sum of delta S with respect to the field times the delta in the field, this is another way of writing it, then we can say that delta SH with respect to the metric and divided by determinant metric, it's just equal to this stuff. It was all just the stuff inside the brackets, and so that should be equal to 0. And so what that says is that in a vacuum, for least action and matter energy, you get at least the left-hand side of Einstein's equation. And the matter-energy fields are just going to add constants to this. And so we see that by just simply saying that the action, if the action were equal to this Hilbert action, and then, you know, divided by some constants plus the matter action, then we get the delta S divided by this delta G, mu nu, and G, and all that other stuff, is equal to this Einstein tensor stuff, plus 1 over the metric and the determinant metric with respect to this matter, delta in the matter action. And that is equal to the stress energy tensor. And I think this actually comes from the definition of stress energy tensor and conservation of energy. So, therefore you get Einstein's equation.
Now, for a scalar field
that varies with the metric, we would have a delta in a scalar field which looks like this, where you have, this is like the kinetic energy part, that and you can see that here we have it varying with the metric, and here we have it varying with the delta of the metric. And that is looped in with the potential. And so you go through a little manipulation, you can see that you can pull out the delta of the metric term out of this whole thing, and it ends up looking like this. And you'll see here that if you take the stress energy tensor of the scalar field and you say it's equal to minus 2 times 1 over square root of G times delta of the action divided by delta of the metric, then this is what you get as a result of just taking that and just dividing it through. And so you can see here you've got this scalar field derivatives.
this term involving scalar field derivatives, but you can see the metric terms are going to cause it to raise one of these while the other one stays down, and you end up getting a scalar multiplication of these two, and then the term involving the potential. If you could transfer this into flat space, then this is what it looks like. And so this is called Noether's theorem, which says that every symmetry in Lagrangian implies the existence of a conservation law. So what's happening here is you have the stress energy tensor made up of something that looks like kinetic energy, and then you have this other term which looks sort of like kinetic energy, but it's you see this minus 1/2 term, so that when you add the two of them together, you get like the 1/2 mv squared part, and then you have this part with potential.
Are those supposed to be eta dot or no?
No, not eta dot. That's just a little. That's just something where I think I just wrote a little bit extra from my pencil. And so each one of these implies a conservation law. Every symmetry of Lagrangian applies a conservation law. So if S mu nu is given by the variation of Lagrangian, and you say that if you take a derivative or divergence of that, you get zero, then for scalar field in Minkowski spacetime, you have this law that kind of comes out from the least action principle, which is basically the definition of the Hamiltonian. And that's also called they call it the canonical E&M tensor, and it's basically similar to a Hamiltonian density. And so this is kind of why it looks like this. And so you can see that this thing that we assume that the stress energy tensor had to look like in order to complete the full Einstein equations is what it needs to look like if we have this thing called the Hamiltonian that works. Okay, so any questions?
It still looks like math.
Yeah, well, it's math that related to some physics, so.
The word action is in this textbook, S representing action.
Mm-hmm.
More kinds of actions than just the Hilberts.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the reason why they refer to this, I think, as the Hilbert action. I'm trying to figure out exactly why. I think it's just because that was who first did it or something like that. Yeah, the Hilbert action, or sometimes the Einstein-Hilbert action, as they call it.
So throughout the rest of the chapter, when they refer to action, they're referring to this Hilbert-Einstein action.
They could just be referring to just a general action principle. The Hilbert-Einstein action means that you're definitely referring to having this R as your Lagrangian.
Okay.
But later on, like when they talked about the stress energy tensor and the scalar field, they weren't necessarily referring to R as being the Lagrangian. Like here, the Lagrangian actually came from the scalar field. So this is just a scalar action, which is a different thing. And I think the argument for why S1 disappeared, the one way they explain this is basically that the contribution of this at the boundary, as you take the boundaries of this all the way out to infinity, it just disappears. Because if you when you go from having this full metric to just having a hypersurface, when you're integrating a hypersurface out to infinity, that's why this
variation vanishes, because if you know, the whole idea is that you're looking at the same the boundaries being constant and the variations disappearing at the boundary, but everything else being able to vary. So as soon as you got this down to the point where there was just a covariant derivative of all the stuff in the brackets, you were done. Just a little side note. And they get into some really interesting tensor math stuff along the way. Okay, any other questions? So if that's it for today, I'll end this recording.